Auher oco eco ca aha. Inahe kuliana imua okea aha. Ho o kolo kolo ki e ki e hana hano okamoku aina o Hawaii. E naui mai, ima leo mai, ilohe ia kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Case number SCAP 19449, Keep the North Shore Country versus Board of Land and Natural Resources et al. Arguing for the appellant, Lance D. Collins. Arguing for the appellee, BLNR, UNC Rayner, Deputy Solicitor General. Arguing for the appellee, Napua Makani Power Partners, John P. Minot. Argument on the merits.
All right, good afternoon. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, and I want to thank and welcome Judge Matthew Viola for joining the court today by reason of vacancy. During the proceeding, should a justice have a question, they will raise their hand virtually, and I'll call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to start today by asking our attorneys to introduce themselves and the order in which they'll be arguing.
Aloha. I am Lance Collins. I will be arguing for the appellant.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Ewan Rayner, appearing on behalf of the State of Hawaii Board of Land and Natural Resources.
Good afternoon, Justices. John P. Minot, appearing for the appellee applicant, Napua Makani Power Partner.
All right, thank you all. And just to confirm our allotment of time, Mr. Collins, you'll have 15 minutes for your initial argument with 15 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Mr. Rayner, you'll have 15 minutes. Mr. Minot, you'll have 15 minutes. And you'll get a warning with 5 minutes to go in your argument. Each of you will see a light and hear a tone at the end of your allotted time. Mr. Collins, please proceed with your argument.
Aloha, ai olo olo ai, ka'aha ho kolo kolo kie kie. Aloha, and may it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and Associate Justices. This case is about the living heritage of Hawaii. It is about the Opeapea, according to the Kumulipo, the last class of creature to appear in the universe before the dawn of humans. It is guessed that between a few hundred and a few thousand total remain existing throughout the main Hawaiian islands. Opeapea are a long-lived species with very low reproductive rates, making populations susceptible to localized extinction. Every wind power project in Hawaii has killed Opeapea. Every habitat conservation plan approved in Hawaii has underestimated how many Opeapea would be killed. In this case, 51 Opeapea are being permitted to be killed over a 20-year period. If other facilities are comparable, this amount will be reached well before then. What this case is not about, and what the matter before the BLNR was not about, is achieving Hawaii's goal of 100% renewable energy. It's not about how much carbon dioxide emissions will be reduced compared to power generated by burning imported oil. What this case is not about, and what it was not about before the BLNR, is balancing competing interests of environmental, public policy, and benefits to the public from generating electricity by wind power. Contrary to the circuit court's characterization of this case as being green versus green, this case is about an administrative agency failing to follow the standards set by the legislature regarding the protection of endangered species. In enacting the laws that make up HRS 195D, the legislature provided clear standards for the BLNR to take positive actions to ensure the continued perpetuation of indigenous wildlife and their habitats for human enjoyment, for scientific purposes, and as members of ecosystems to ensure their survival. The BLNR failed to do this when, in overruling the hearings officer, it applied the wrong standard in evaluating the evidence and glossed over the failure of the applicant to meet its burden. Similarly, this court has provided what kind of minimum standards must be followed in order for an adjudicative proceeding to constitute fair and due process. While the great weight of law is against a judge or juror being a witness in any case where they serve as in a fact-finding role, here we have a board member who did just that. Mr. Gon served as a member of the Endangered Species Recovery Committee as the appointee of the chair. He also purports to be an expert in the study of Opeapea and disclosed strong opinions about the propriety of the application, the correctness of his recommendations while serving on that committee, and freely referenced a whole range of information not disclosed in the record or available to the tribunal.
Mr. Collins, if you could, on the issue of Mr. Gahn's participation, there's the Liberty Dialysis case that was decided by this court that admittedly talked about a different statute, different situation, but that statute appeared to reflect the judgment that the person who had participated in an earlier proceeding could also participate in a reconsideration. Why do you think that's not applicable here, particularly in light of the provision that appears, according to the state, to indicate that the board chair could serve in both of these functions and that the board chair then can designate someone to sit on the committee, and in this case designated Mr. Gahn?
Well, with respect to Liberty Dialysis, the first issue with that case, which makes it distinguishable, is that the parties in Liberty Dialysis were focused on the administrative rule, which basically disqualified the administrator from serving in both of those capacities. And of course, that administrative rule contravened the statute which allowed it to be in this case. In this case, Keep the North Shore Country is arguing that its right to due process, which is a constitutional right, was contravened when Mr. Gahn was allowed to serve in both of these roles. Now, with respect to the statute, which allows the chairperson to serve in both of these roles, is not before the court. And perhaps there's a question about whether or not that is appropriate. I do know that in the Waiahole case, the court said that it's likely not an absolute bar. And in that instance, there was no evidence that the chairperson at that time could not serve in both of those roles. In this case, however, the chairperson didn't serve on the Endangered Species Recovery Committee. And there's nothing in the statute that says, well, to the extent that the chairperson can serve in both of these roles, the chairperson can also pick anybody else on the board to serve in both of these roles, especially when there's due process considerations. And so in this instance, the statute does not permit the board chairperson to pick another member of the board to serve on these roles. And even if in some instance it might be allowed, the facts in this case definitely demonstrate why Mr. Gahn should not have been permitted to serve in both of these roles, because it's not simply just the application of institutional conflicts here. Mr. Gahn is exactly the reason why a juror is not allowed to serve as a witness in a case where they serve as a juror, and definitely why a judge is not allowed to serve as a witness in a case where the judge is the fact finder. And if I could point or quote to the commentary to Rule 605 of the Rules of Evidence, I think these questions definitely come to mind with the facts in this case. Who rules on objections? Who compels a judge to answer? Can he rule impartially on the weight and admissibility of his own testimony? Can he be impeached or cross-examined effectively? Can he, in a jury trial, avoid conferring his seal of approval on one side in the eyes of the jury? Can he, in a bench trial, avoid an involvement destructive of impartiality? And I think that those are the questions that are brought in this instance. Where the
Justice Nakayama had a question. Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Collins, in NAPUA's answering brief, they state that there was that KNSC was present, had complete opportunities to participate in the ESRC meetings and did in fact attend and participate. Now the meetings ran from July 2014 all the way to February 2016. Mr. Gahn's first meeting was not until December 2015. In light of those facts, why is Judge Crabtree wrong in saying that your objection to Mr. Gahn is waived because it's dilatory? It should have been made sooner.
Well, I think the record also shows that Mr. Gahn himself didn't even remember that he had participated in that committee meeting until much later in the proceedings. So
actually, I don't recall that. I think what he said was, he didn't say he didn't participate. He said he didn't have substantial input to, which would be consistent with him not getting until not joining the committee until the next to the last meeting. So anyway, go ahead.
Well, yes, except that he remembered much later that in fact he had moved to recommend approval of the project. So, you know, to the extent that, you know, he himself did not have a clear memory of what his participation had been several years earlier.
I disagree with that. He at first said he didn't provide substantial input to, and later he said he considered the issue currently. I don't think that that's showing a lack of memory. It's consistent. But regardless, if KNSC had been participating in ESRC's meetings and had attended as NAPUA stated in their brief and to which you did not dispute in your reply brief, why is your objection not untimely, as Judge Crabtree said?
Well, the objection is not untimely because, first of all, the Endangered Species Recovery Committee's proceedings, Keep the North Shore Country, wasn't a party. And so the fact that he participated in that, at that point, they were not required to object. And I think that the time in which they did object was timely under the circumstances. This is not an instance like in Waiahole where the whole proceeding basically ended before the intervener in that case decided to challenge the land board chairs or the seaworm chairs dual role. This occurred before decision making happened. There was extensive briefing on it before a decision was made. And in terms of the timeliness of it, we don't think it's untimely. And definitely with the kind of behavior that that occurred in this particular proceeding, definitely we don't think that the timeliness issue should even be a relevant factor in this case.
Justice Wilson has a question, Mr. Collins. Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Collins, I wanted to bring you back to the findings of the hearing officer in this case that were not accepted by the LAM board. The hearing officer seemed to think it was significant that the rotor size increased from 153 to 200 and thought it was significant that the speed with which the rotors would start, the LWSC, was, I guess, too low at 5. And also the failure of NAPUA to rely upon data from the Kahuku Wind Project were all reasons that the plan for recovery, the conservation plan, was inadequate. And why wouldn't it be the case that the conditions that were added by the land board when it made its decision to not accept the recommendation of the hearing officer, why wouldn't those conditions have addressed the concerns of the hearing officer?
Well, the standard under 4G1 is the maximum extent practicable, and in this instance, the findings are replete with instances where the maximum extent is not being followed. The low wind speed curtailment. There was some evidence that there was a 78% decrease in bat mortality at the 6.5 meters per second cut-in speed. And the issue of, is there enough data on that? The land boards, the hearings officer said there's not enough evidence. And instead of the land board saying, oh, well, this is these are facts that you overlooked, hearings officer, instead, they just said, well, we're just not going to consider anything that is inconsistent with the decision to approve this. And so, for instance, saying, well, there's not enough data at the 6.5 meter per second cut-in speed, so therefore we'll rely at the 5 meter per second cut-in speed, is essentially saying, unless you have research showing that enough bats are killed, we're not going to consider that research, which is exactly the opposite of the maximum extent practicable. The whole point of the maximum extent practicable standard is to avoid killing endangered species. So if the research shows that at a higher cut-in speed, bats aren't being killed, I mean, that's the definition of maximum extent practicable, basically. And what the land board did was just gloss over that. Any evidence that didn't suit approval of this, they didn't say, hearings officer, you overlooked this evidence. Instead, they just said, well, here are reasons why, even though there is no evidence, we're not going to consider the evidence, focusing on something that had nothing to do with the standards that they were supposed to apply.
If I may, what about the change in the size of the rotor? What, if any, indication was there that that would increase the taking of the bats?
So the issue of the increased rotor speed, I mean, that's one of the issues that had that I think implicates.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean the rotor speed. I was talking about the height of the rotor going from 153 to 200. I think then it was reduced to 172.
Yeah, so that issue ties in with the overall issue of only considering the Kahuku wind project, as opposed to identifying all of the factors or the model to why the Kahuku wind data would be considered and none of the other data in the region. And that's one of the problems that makes the board's decision arbitrary, is that the hearings officer identified there's no evidence to support all of these things, and there's no identification of a model of how to address this other than to disregard reliable data. And the land board didn't solve that. They just basically repeated the arguments of the applicant why they didn't consider some data. And I just wanted to finish that question. I just wanted to also note that, you know, the problem here is that they said, well, the best science says this, the best science says that. But the best science is able to account for all of the data that is collected scientifically. And so if you say, well, we're only going to consider the data that was collected next door, but we're not going to consider any other data or explain what is the relationship for whatever we think the data next door means for us, our model can't account for why the data that's collected somewhere else occurs that way. I mean, that's the scientific method, is to have an explanation of all the data. I mean, it's like the difference between saying the sun is the center of the solar system and the earth is. There's like all sorts of things that you have to disregard in order to accept the earth as the center of the solar system, which is why most, basically all scientists don't agree with it, because it doesn't account for all of the factors that are observable. And this is that same type of situation where it's cherry picking the data that suits the conclusion, as opposed to being able to explain all of the reliable data that's presented. And that's exactly what the hearings officer said. And if I may be permitted to reserve the balance of my time.
Justice McKenna has a question, though. Okay. Justice McKenna.
Just a quick question. Mr. Collins, do the BLNR statutes or administrative rules, would they have allowed the chair to appoint Mr. Gaughan to serve on the committee as a member of the board while he was a member of the board?
The statute simply says that the chair of the board or her designee can serve on the Endangered Species Recovery Committee. It doesn't qualify who that is. Our argument is that due process in this instance does not permit the chair to appoint another member of the board.
Justice McKenna, does that complete your question?
Yes,
Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Just a quick question. You had raised the issue as to whether the ex parte communication in this case would have rendered the decision, if in your view, required a remand. But I wanted to ask you, what happened to the letter? I know you requested the letter, and I wanted to know whether it was determined that the letter was still in existence or whether it was no longer to be found.
Yes, Your Honor. It's not in the record. And I think that that's the problem, is that Keep the North Shore Country was not able to determine exactly what board members had seen and the level of prejudice that they had. And of course, no reviewing court was able to do that because I had disappeared.
You kind of lost me there. Did you say it disappeared? Is that what you said, the letter? What was the status of the letter?
Sure. So the record discloses that the chairperson saw it, that the board staff distributed it to the entire board. The chairperson then said, don't read it. And then Keep the North Shore Country.
I understand it existed at one time. I was interested in what happened when you requested it. What was the understanding of where it was when you requested it?
That the department indicated that they did not presently at the time of the requesting of the record maintain the record.
Thank you.
Was that request made during the hearing or subsequently?
It was made in writing. When it was announced that it had occurred.
Okay.
That the writing had been, that the board chair had seen it and had been distributed.
When was that issue raised by Keep the North Shore Country? Was it not raised until the circuit court proceedings, or was it raised? And when I say that issue, I mean the disclosure of the letter itself, as opposed to whether the context had occurred.
The request to obtain a copy of the communication is what appears in the agency record. And that issue was argued at the circuit court.
Very well. No further questions at this time. We'll have you reserve your time, and then we'll move on to Mr. Rayner.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices, and Circuit Judge Vice.
Mr. Rayner,
I appear to have been muted there for a second. I'll start again. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justices, and Circuit Judge Viola. I'd like, if I may, to focus on the two more procedural issues that Keep the North Shore Country has raised here. First, the fact that BLNR member Sam Gon was involved as a member of the Endangered Species Recovery Committee and voted to recommend approval of the Habitat Conservation Plan did not disqualify him from subsequently serving on the board in its consideration of the Habitat Conservation Plan as part of a separate contested case hearing. And second, appellant's right to due process was in no way violated by a letter sent to the board by a state legislator that was not read by any of the board members. Regarding the first of those two issues, appellant has raised a number of sub-points, but their overarching argument is that because BLNR member Gon was involved in the Endangered Species Recovery Committee's deliberations on the Habitat Conservation Plan and voted to recommend approval of the Habitat Conservation Plan, he was subsequently disqualified from serving on the board. But that is wrong for a couple of reasons. First, there's certainly no statutory bar to Gon serving on both the Endangered Species Recovery Committee and the board. The legislature has recognized in HRS 195-25A that there is no inherent conflict when the same individual serves on both the ESRC and the board. We recognize that Sam Gon is not the chairperson. And in fact, just to clarify something, he was also not the board's designee. Sam Gon was actually appointed to the Endangered Species Recovery Committee, not by the board chair as a designee, but because of his expertise and background in Native Hawaiian cultural and traditional practices, which is a required membership. At least one member of the committee is required to have that expertise and under the relevant statute. But the reason we argue that statute and why it's important is because there's no logical or legal reason to conclude that an ordinary board member like Sam Gon could not be impartial or could not be not biased in the exact same situation that the legislature had recognized that the board chair can be impartial and can be unbiased. And in addition, I think this court has previously recognized that there's no inherent conflict when the same officer serves in both an initial adjudicatory capacity and then also serves as a member of a committee that reconsiders that initial decision as part of a contested case hearing. And that's the Liberty Dialysis case that's discussed extensively in our briefs and that was referenced earlier. And although, as the court noted earlier, that case did primarily involve the specific rules and statutes that were applicable to the State Health Planning and Development Agency, the court in Liberty Dialysis did also explicitly note that the administrator was subject to the same due process appearance of impropriety standard, and yet the court still affirmed the administrator's dual roles.
Mr. Rayner, we have a question from Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Rayner, I wanted to ask you while you're discussing appearance of impropriety about the position of the Board of Land and Natural Resources that is taken pursuant to the advice of your office when it comes to the production of documents. Now, I know that there was some reliance on the Kila Kila case, and it is true that the majority did not find improper repeated ex parte communications that were undisclosed. But that analysis seemed to depend upon the notion that the representations of DLNR were that there were no discussions on the merits. And on that basis, the majority also found it was not improper to refuse to disclose the documents that showed what the ex parte communication was. Fortunately, through a public records request, the documents were obtained. But in this case, isn't it different? I mean, is it your position wasn't necessary to either maintain this letter or to disclose it because it wasn't a letter that concerned the merits? Or was this letter something that discussed the merits and actually discussed the merits of the project?
Okay. Well, I think there's a couple of things that are really important to note about this. And I think the first is that the reason that the letter is not in the record, and the reason that we don't know all the details of why the board didn't disclose it is because Keep the North Shore Country never raised it as an objection, and they never requested a letter as part of this contested case procedure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that's helpful, because does that mean that from the point of view of the board, the document would have been produced, because I haven't been able to see that from the record, that it's the position that you're taking, the board would have been obligated to actually provide the letter if it had been requested?
Well, I'm not exactly taking that position. And the fact is, it's not clear. And I can't answer that question, because
there's a practice on the part of your office to advise the board that it doesn't have to release documents that show ex parte communication with the sitting judicial officer during the deliberation phase of the case. And from what I understand your argument to be, you also have no obligation to maintain a record of that. Is that correct? You have no obligation to keep the letter?
Well, first of all, I would say I think it probably is likely. I don't think I can say without the record being more fleshed out, which would have occurred if there was an objection. You know, it is likely the board, if it had possession of the letter, would have been required to disclose it pursuant to a public records request. But whether the board was required to maintain, you know, this court has said several times before that the Chapter 92F doesn't, there's no obligation created in that statute to require the board to maintain a record. And so it's a separate factual issue as to whether the board maintained it and whether the board was required to maintain it that would have been addressed if Keep the North Shore Country had followed up on their public records request. You know, so what happened is after the board's hearing, where the existence of the letter and the fact that no board members had read it was disclosed by the chair, after that, appellant made an objection to Member Gon's participation, but didn't make any mention of any objection or any request for further information about the letter. And then later, after the hearing, I think it was around a month after the hearing, they submitted a UEFA records request. And the board responded by saying it didn't maintain a copy of that record. And the record's not clear on why, you know, whether it was deleted, whether it was sent back to the legislator, it's not present in the record. But Keep the North Shore Country did.
I might mention that it was in Justice Pollack's dissent, but there is, I think, a legitimate issue about whether when the board or an agency during the time that the deliberations are taking place receives ex parte communication, it should maintain the record that it receives and not either destroy it or put it in another location so it's no longer in the agency's control.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, as you say, to the extent that was in Kila Kila, I believe that was only in the dissent, and I'm not aware of any, you know, legal requirement that would have required the board to do so without an objection in this case, or without Keep the North Shore Country stating that they wished for further questioning or further information about the letter. And in addition, I would just point out that Keep the North Shore Country did have further recourse after the board responded to their UEPA request. Under Chapter 92F-15 and 15.5, they can either take the board's denial of the request to the Office of Information Practices, or they can appeal to a circuit court. But they didn't do either of those things, and that's why we don't have a detailed record on this.
Mr. Rayner, we have a question from Judge Viola. Judge Viola.
Oh, there you go. Good afternoon, Mr. Rayner. My question is regarding the timing of the Keep the North Shore Country's motion to disqualify Member Gon from proceedings. When should Keep the North Shore Country have made that motion either orally in writing?
You know, essentially what this court's cases have said is that an objection to an adjudicatory administrator's role needs to come either before the proceeding begins or as soon as possible once the facts become known. And, you know, I suppose the standard would be within a reasonable time after the facts become known. And so, you know, we've obviously made the argument that initially that should have been after Gon's initial disclosure. But even if this court were to say, you know, that disclosure could have been more detailed, even though we believe it was sufficient, you know, at the very, very latest, July 12th, 2017, is when, as part of the contested case hearing, Keep the North Shore Country stipulated to admission of all of the ESRC's minutes, which are all public meeting minutes. So at the very latest, that is when Keep the North Shore Country had full knowledge that Gon was on the ESRC, made the motion to recommend approval of the Habitat Conservation Plan and voted to recommend approval. But there were, I believe, at least three board meetings. you know, the objection to Gon, so that was on July 12, 2017, and the objection to Gon's participation didn't come until January 12, 2018, which is when the board held oral arguments. This is after the evidentiary portion of the contested case hearing had occurred, after the hearing officer had issued recommendations and at the board's oral arguments.
Just briefly, if I can kind of move back to the initial disclosure that Member Gon had made in, it was at the November 10, 2016 meeting. And in substance, what he said was he was briefly on the Endangered Species Advisory or Recovery Committee that advises wind farm projects. He was no longer on that committee, and that this particular company proposal was not one that he provided substantial input to. Is that an accurate statement? And if so, was Keep the North Shore Country entitled to rely on that statement?
Well, first, I do think it is an accurate statement. Gon joined the Endangered Species Recovery Committee in June 2015. The ESRC's first meeting on this habitat conservation plan was back in about a year before that, July 2nd, 2014. And there were, the majority of the ESRC's deliberations on this habitat conservation plan, the majority of their meetings were before Gon ever even joined the committee. And for example, the ESRC did their site visit. They considered the draft HCP before Gon even joined the committee. So he didn't even do the site visit with the ESRC. So I do think it's an accurate statement. And I would say, even though the initial Gon's initial disclosure didn't state that he had voted on the recommendation, that is a public meeting. There's public available records, and Keep the North Shore Country's representatives had been the majority of the meetings, and so we do think that disclosure was adequate. Yes,
Justice McKenna.
I have two questions. First, my first question is, for example, in our courts, if a justice has to recuse, we have procedures in place to replace those justices. And it's my understanding that these types of the habitat plan had to be approved by at least 2/3 of the board members. So we know that at least one person recused, Mr. Rory. And I'm just wondering, does the board have a process to replace board members to allow a sufficient number of people to consider an application, whatever it might be, if a certain number of people recuse? And my second question is, follows up in what Judge Viola was asking, is it the board's position that people are on notice of issues that could subject a board member to disqualification or recusal if minutes are filed? In other words, it's the public's obligation to sift through minutes to try to figure it out. Do you think then that this court should clearly impose an obligation of administrative adjudicators to provide the kinds of disclosures that are required of judges?
Okay, so to answer the first question,
the first question refers to, my understanding is that, the habitat plan would have had to been considered by at least five people. And what if, do you have a process for replacing people if you can't?
I remember now. I'm not aware of any procedure that the board has for that. And certainly, obviously, that didn't occur in this case. So you are correct that, there is required to be a 2/3 vote. And because there was one recusal and the ultimate vote was 5-1, then essentially Gon would be the deciding vote. But I'm not aware of the board's procedure, certainly a written procedure for the board to replace members.
Okay, so are you aware of any law or case law? For example, for judges, we have there's common law recognizing what we call a rule of necessity. In other words, it could be a situation in which judges must otherwise recuse, but there are no other judges that can hear the matter. Are you aware of whether or not the rule of necessity has been applied to administrative adjudicators?
I'm not aware of whether it has or it hasn't.
Okay, and then my follow-up is the other issue of,
right,
is it really your position that the public is on notice just because minutes are filed?
So what we're arguing here is that it was Keep the North Shore Country specifically that stipulated to the admission of those minutes into the contested case hearing record. And so, you know, it's different from a situation. We're not necessarily arguing that just because they're public minutes, then everybody's on notice of it. But when, you know, we've got an adversarial procedure like a contested case hearing, and one of the parties stipulates to admission of documents that show that the person they're objecting to was a member of the committee, then yes, they are on actual notice that Gon was on the committee and voted to recommend approval of the Habitat Conservation Plan. So that's our position.
Mr. Rayner, why is it your position that the 6 months was unreasonable? In other words, from July until January, and if so, why? And where does that analysis, upon what is that analysis based?
So yes, that's our position. Analysis is based on this court's holdings in the past, and I believe this in the Waiahole case, this decision in our discussion in our brief, the court referenced the standard that an objection to the participation of a member needs to come either before the participation, that's before the procedure is initiated, or if that's not possible, when the facts that give rise to the disqualification become known to the party. And the reason we think that's, the reason that's the standard is because these kind of contested case hearings, they require a lot of time and they require a lot of work. And the board members, they put a lot of time into reviewing these extremely voluminous record and an extremely complicated record. And, it would be an extremely inefficient process if parties are permitted to wait 6 months when potentially the board members are reviewing all of this evidence to then say we object to the participation of one of the members.
Well, Justice McKenna.
Thank you. I had one additional question regarding the board. As I recall, the laws have been changed, so the board has to have members designated to represent certain types of background or expertise. Is Mr. Gon one of those appointees, or is he a regular board member?
He is one of those appointees. He was actually appointed to the board, I believe, for his background in conservation and natural resources. But he would actually also fill the role. There's two required roles. One with a member with a background in conservation and natural resources, and one with an expertise in Native Hawaiian customary and traditional practices. And although Gon was specifically appointed for the former, he would actually qualify for both of those, I think, yes.
But he was appointed as the conservation person.
Yes.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
So in other words, if there is no process for substitution in the event of recusal, then the board would be missing that voice.
I believe that's right. Yes. Yes.
Very well. Mr. Rayner, we've gone well over your time. We've asked a number of questions. Anything just to quickly wrap up before we move to Mr. Manat?
I don't believe I have anything else, and I don't want to cut more into Mr. Manat's time. So I would just respectfully ask that this court affirm the circuit court's order affirming the board's decision. Thank you.
We will give Mr. Manat his full time since we ran over due to questions. Mr. Manat?
May it please the court, Chief Justice Ruckenwald and justices of the court, John P. Manat appearing for appellee applicant Napua Makani Power Partners. This renewable wind energy project is consistent with and promotes two important statutory schemes, HRS 269-92, which mandates a reduction in use of fossil fuels by 2045, and Chapter 195D governing a renewable wind energy farm that inadvertently takes Hawaiian hoary bats or opeapea incidental to its lawful activity, so long as it is under an approved HCP plan. The plan approved here by the board does not jeopardize the continued existence of the Hawaiian hoary bat. It is based on the best available science that's compiled by the experts who were members of the ESRC, as well as two testifying experts at the contested case hearing below, who all concluded that the plan is designed to enhance the likelihood of the bat survival and recovery as a species. Now, this project will not only reduce dependence on fossil fuels on Oahu, it will avoid almost 1 million tons of CO2 over its 20-year term based on a PPA with HECO. It is designed to clearly reduce the impacts on the opeapea as well as other endangered species. On the issue of low wind speed curtailment, there was no evidence presented by any expert that the board's advisory committee, the ESRC here, in following its own bat guidance, failed to follow the best available science in recommending that the speed commence at 5 meters per second. Low wind speed curtailment at 5 meters per second is highly effective, and that is shown in this area by the neighboring Kahuku Wind Farm, which was chosen as the best surrogate for this project because of its close proximity, immediately adjacent neighbor. It has similar habitat, vegetation, topography, wind direction, and levels of bat activity. Kahuku has operated for over 7 years now, utilizing low wind speed curtailment. It had 12 wind turbines, or four more than Napua's project with eight. And it also utilizes low wind speed curtailment at 5 meters per second. There have been no reported observed bat takes at Kahuku since August 29, 2014. At that point, there was one observed bat take. So at that rate, even with one observed inadvertent take every 5 years or so, Napua will get nowhere near its tier one allowance of 34 bats. So the estimates presented by the ESRC and approved by the board are clearly reasonable based on the next door neighbor's actual data results. Now, with respect to the de novo review of Judge Crabtree's order that affirmed the BLNR decision, Chapter 195, there were no factual findings demonstrated to be clearly erroneous by the appellant in their briefs. The Judge Crabtree's order should be affirmed based on the correct standard that was applied in reviewing not only the factual findings that were very extensive in the board's decision and order, but there is nothing that was wrong in the conclusions of law. The plan is reasonable and appropriate because it basically sets low wind speed curtailment at 5 meters per second, which is based on the consensus of the best available science by the experts who looked at this project. Secondly, it conforms with the exact letter of the BAT guidance that was in effect at the time. And it's also based on the recommendation of the Division of Forestry and Wildlife, DOFA. And those are the experts who are designated to determine whether the settings are correct and appropriate for meeting the standard in the statute to satisfy minimization to the maximum extent practicable.
Now we have a question from Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Manau, what information or data was provided to the board with respect to the effect of changing the rotor height from 150 to 200 meters?
So the height issue was addressed and considered by the ESRC, and it was also considered fully in the contested case hearing. So
didn't the Endangered Species Recovery Committee analyze it from the point of view of 156 meters?
Now, it was ultimately increased to a maximum of 200 meters, and that is what the ESRC ultimately reviewed. KNSC's representative was present at the various meetings. There was no objection raised.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you help me with this question about whether the Endangered Species Recovery Committee was doing any literature or any studies that had to do with the effect of the increase of the height to 200 meters, because I thought that was a concern of the hearing officer, that there weren't those studies weren't conducted and that the data that was presented to the endangered species was presented at that time to the recovery committee was focused on 156 feet.
All right, so the studies that were reviewed for this project include the 2016 Zimmerling report, and that is the best available science that addresses the issue of height and changes in height. And there's no science and no conclusion from that report that states that height would have any quantifiable change in existing bat take estimates. So
wasn't the hearing officer concerned because the relationship between a bat taking and the height of the rotors was addressed in literature, albeit literature after the Zimmerling report?
Yes, so the Zimmerling report was considered ultimately in the contested case hearing. It is unclear what exactly the ESRC reviewed when they initially reviewed this, although there was no science. And again, this is the standard. What is the best available science at the time when they reviewed it? So there's no science saying that the height change would be would require some adjustment in the take estimate.
So would it be your position then it doesn't matter how high the rotors are when it comes to evaluating the take on the Opeopea?
Yeah, so the expert's view is the current science concludes that there is no significant change, number one. And number two, when you look at the neighboring property, the Pahuku project, with 128 meters versus the 173 meters here, they're operating with 12 turbines and Nakua has 8. The findings from the board concluded that essentially the rough rotor swept area would be about the same. So in estimating the take estimates, there really shouldn't be any significant difference based on the total area impacted by rotating blades, height-wise or otherwise, based on the total number of turbines that have been used and the size. Now, of course, as science evolves and develops during the next few years, the critical point with ESRC and the Habitat Conservation Plan is the concept of adaptive management. Essentially, that's the catch-all here in case somebody is wrong with their crystal ball or wrong on what the science says about how to set take. And that is a process whereby through monitoring of the project with yearly reports from the owner and upon immediate reporting of any actual bat take, the requirement to report within 24 hours any take of a bat, they will know immediately what is occurring on the project. And over time, if it appears that there is some risk that the rate of take is too high over the 20-year period, then certainly the agencies have the power, and it's a required condition under the DNO, that adaptive management step in and consider raising speeds or doing other adjustments that can positively impact the take estimates. So the adaptive management part, I believe, is really the sort of the glue to the whole thing. And Judge Crabtree recognized in his order that paragraph 8 that the adaptive measures should step in and provide further protection, and is the oversight and corrective process built into the HCP. So in essence, this project is, as Judge Crabtree would conclude, what we would really consider to be a win-win for the environment. You've got essentially a project that's going to reduce dependence on fossil fuels, and also is designed to increase the habitat, the forested areas, and recovery of the Hawaiian hoary bat. Now, the mitigation areas that are involved for this project were also addressed. And from the perspective of the board, the correct mitigation or the way to offset any anticipated take is through the extensive efforts to improve habitat for the bat at the Poamoho Ridge area, in addition to extensive funding of under Tier 1 for the 34 bat take estimate. There's almost $1.8 million required to fund actually fencing, improving that forest habitat. The bat guidance itself is very informative, and it points out how degradation of bat habitat is the most important factor that the science understands is affecting and potentially adversely impacting the survival of the bat. So any improvement and enhancement of the habitat where the Hawaiian hoary bat lives and breeds and forages would increase the chances of survival. And ultimately, that's where the emphasis is under the bat guidance, is increasing the bat habitat areas in addition to funding. So this plan clearly follows the scientific experts' advice on the habitat restoration. It's providing the funding. They've also committed to about $100,000 on bat deterrent analysis and technology. So the issues of improving the habitat is really where the mitigation for this comes into play, and there's a significant level of contribution.
We have about a minute and a half to go. Anything further for the court at this time?
I've got nothing. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Very well. No, thank you for your argument, and we'll turn back to Mr. Collins for his rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Manat.
Thank you.
One thing that I wanted to mention I was not able to in the opening was that we mistakenly cited the dissent in Kila Kila o Haleakala. Although the portions of law that we cited, we believe are consistent with the majority. The difference between the majority and the dissent in Kila Kila had to do with evaluating the facts in that case as opposed to the legal principles, which seem to be not in dispute between the majority and the dissent.
Thank you for the clarification. Could you respond to Mr. Rayner with regard to his argument that Keep the North Shore Country was aware in July of 17 that Mr. Gahn had made the motion to approve this the plan in the committee, and so it was on notice and should have filed or moved to have him step aside sooner than January of the following year?
Our position is that it's not exactly what happened. I mean, what happened here was that a hearings officer took all of this information in. So the minutes and everything from the committee were stipulated into the record. And then there was a contested case hearing that Mr. Gahn was not a participant in. Mr. Gahn did not show up again in this process until the time when Keep the North Shore Country moved for him to be recused in January of 2018. Ms. Izu, who is the hearings officer, wasn't Mr. Gahn, and they obviously none of the parties had a problem with her impartiality, and so nobody asked for her to be recused. So this issue that at the moment they stipulated in this voluminous record into the contested case hearing, they also immediately had to ask for recusal or had constructive knowledge of everything that was in those documents. I don't think is a reasonable construction of what's required of a litigant.
Very well. We have three questions pending, starting with Justice McKenna. And I think we also have Justice Wilson and Judge Viola. Justice McKenna.
With respect to the citation to the dissent, because I know that it was raised by your opponents, I want to make it clear that the Mauna Kea, the TMT decision in 2018 adopted that dissent as a part of the majority opinion, the legal standard. So I don't see that as an issue. That's the only thing I wanted to point out. It's not really a question. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Justice McKenna. Justice Wilson, I believe you were next, and then Judge Viola.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Collins, I wanted to get your response to the idea that the change in the height, the rotor height, and as well as the limitation of the consideration of the Endangered Species Recovery Committee to just the adjacent Kahuku wind farms constituted the scientific the scientific information that was the best information at the time, and that the height of the rotor was not relevant to the bat take?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is one of the clear points where the board adopted utilized the wrong standard. The statute says best available scientific and other reliable data available, not best available science, whatever that means. It's supposed to consider the best available scientific and other reliable data. And as the hearings officer indicated, there was no explanation and there was no evidence introduced to explain why all of the other data around the North Shore should not be considered in determining all of these factors, except for the project that I guess was the most favorable to this project. I mean, it should also be noted that the applicant relied on data from the U.S. mainland and Canada for certain aspects of bat mortality. So it's, you know, best available scientific and other reliable data. That's the standard. That's at 195D21B1. So the standard isn't best available science, whatever that means. It's not up to an expert or some other witness to basically discount a whole bunch of best available scientific and other reliable data to say that the science will only consider some of it and then not actually show his or her work on how they got to that. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that climate change deniers do, where they cherry pick what they want and then they recouch it as that's what science says when it's not.
So what relief then are you requesting? Are you requesting that there be a remand that allows for an analysis of additional wind farms and analysis of the correlation, if any, between the size or the height of the rotors and bat taking? What is your request for relief?
Yes, the request for relief is that the approval be vacated, that it be remanded to the agency so that the agency can conduct further examination of the issues that were specifically pointed out by the hearings officer where evidence was missing. And if the board wants to consider approving this project, that it needs to go through those gaps and address them based on the standard and the statute, not on the standard of because we're going to eliminate carbon emissions or whatever other standards that came into play that are not part of the statute. Also, to indicate that Mr. Gan should have recused, and also to provide guidance to agencies that when they have written ex parte communications on substantive matters, that they should follow the procedure in Moran versus Guerrero and make that part of the record, and to inform the ex parte communicant that it's being made part of the record. I think that one thing alone will probably solve 99% of all future cases that would ever come to this court regarding ex parte communications with agencies. Definitely going to OIP and complaining is meaningless, because if the agency doesn't maintain the record, they have no obligation to disclose that, which is what they don't have. So going to OIP is not a remedy at all for that.
Mr. Collins, we have questions from Judge Viola, Justice Nakayama, and Justice McKinley with Judge Viola.
Thank you, CJ. Good afternoon, Mr. Collins. I wanted to get back to the timing of the motion to disqualify Mr. Gan, Member Gan. As you, I wanted to get a little bit of a better understanding of why you believe that in July of 2017, when the records were stipulated into evidence as part of the contested case hearing before the hearing officer, why when you said that Mr. Gan was really not part of that proceeding. My understanding is, under the rule, the administrative rules for the board would, regardless of the recommendations of the hearing officer, would have to review those recommendations, decide whether to adopt, to modify, to change. And so he really, it was inevitable at that point, wasn't it, that Mr. Gan would be participating in those proceedings and review those proceedings. And so if you can just respond to that, and if you could also maybe briefly respond to the related question of why didn't Keep the North Shore Country object to Mr. Gan's participation back in November of 2016, when he went on the record, said, I did participate, not substantially, in those proceedings. And he voted against even holding a contested case hearing. Why wouldn't it have been the your client's obligation at that point to raise the issue about his the legitimacy of his participation in the proceedings?
I think to the first point that you asked, I don't know that it's necessarily inevitable that Mr. Gan would have been. He could have resigned. He could have been hit by a bus. I mean, we don't know what would have happened while the hearings officer basically had jurisdiction over the proceedings. So I think it's a little bit of a formal technical point that the state is trying to make, that there's some kind of technical application about when Mr. Gan's recusal should have been made. With respect to the fact that he was in the minority in terms of denying, or he was in the minority of the board that believed that a contested case should not have been granted in this instance, that would have been a good time to have recused him. And it's also possible that they were not fully aware of the extent of his participation. And then I think even more so, when it did go to the board, we quoted it extensively in our brief. Mr. Gan made it very clear that he had very strong opinions about the case, and that he was this expert and he had considered all sorts of things that weren't in the record. And I think at that point, whatever technical defect there may have been in Mr. Gan's seeking Mr. Gan's recusal in 2016. I don't think that forever waived it, especially in light of what was actually in the record, where Mr. Gan clearly had very strong opinions. He had all sorts of knowledge and was referring to matters outside of the record that Keep the North Shore Country had the ability to seek his recusal at that point.
Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Collins, the ESRC is a scientific committee that the board, to a certain extent, asks them to take a look at scientific criteria. Now, in light of this, why, although you say that ESRC ignored other studies, they actually did look at other studies, for instance, the ones on the mainland that I think you've, Indiana, that you thought that they should be looking at, but they didn't ignore it. as scientists, didn't they say those studies don't help us because the high rate of bat fatalities were due to the migration of bats, and bats in Hawaii don't migrate. So why was it wrong, although you say they ignored it, but why was it wrong for them as scientists to look at studies and say that a study doesn't apply to this particular windmill farm?
I think our concern with the ignoring of, it's the ignoring of data, of certain data, but not other data, and not explaining, not creating a model that explains how all the data should be considered. Because otherwise it means that there's one law of the physical world that applies in the area around this project and the Kuku Wind Project, but there's some other law of the physical universe that applies a little bit more to the north at Kualoa. And by not explaining how those two sets of data are related to each other, it's arbitrary and capricious. And I think in the board's own approval, it said, well, if we only put weight on this study 20% or 80% or 50% and 50%, that would be arbitrary. But what they don't say is, well, then why is it arbitrary to do it 0 and 100%? Because you're still just picking up random percentages that are not based on a scientific or some kind of logical explanation. And that's the problem for not accounting for part of the data, is that there's this whole universe and you're cherry picking the information that's worth doing. And the hearings officer noted the absence of that. Mr. Chief Justice, I know I'm run out of time.
McKenna and Justice Wilson, we hit your time, but I'll allow you to, of course, we'll have you answer these two questions and then I'll allow you to wrap up, Mr. Collins. Justice McKenna.
I have two questions. First, with respect to Mr. Gong, my concern, could you follow up on the question I was asking Mr. Rayner, in terms of what is supposed to happen? For example, here we have Mr. Gong, and I assume the board has the Native Hawaiian expert. But what happens if these people, clearly if they were judges, they would not be able to continue sitting. But if they were witnesses or they had participated in this matter below, and then they are appointed to the board to represent certain perspectives, and then they have to recuse, and then Mr. Roerig recuses because of an ex parte communication, and let's say that we're down to four, but the law requires that at least five people consider and approve this type of permit. So how is the BLNR supposed to, how are we supposed to address situations like that when there's no way to replace certain board members? And the second question I have is, you're indicating that any ex parte communication in writing, or I assume orally, let's say somebody left a voicemail on somebody's answering machine, you're saying that it should be made a part of a record. Is that under seal or publicly or just available to the parties? Because one of the things that, for example, like if a judge receives an ex parte communication and recuses on that basis, the judge does not want to make that a part of the public record because the judge does not want to influence the other judges. So are you saying that it should just be made a part of the record for appellate review, filed under seal? I'm a little bit confused about what you mean, that it should be filed. Thank you.
Your Honor, as to the first question related to the rule of necessity, the legislature, and this is at 195D-21B1, has set the threshold to approve a habitat conservation plan of 2/3 of the authorized membership. And elsewhere in law, somebody having to recuse, that is not counted towards the total number of votes. And so the presumption is that if an applicant or a proponent cannot get to the 2/3 of the authorized membership, then they will not be entitled to kill endangered species. That's the policy of the legislature. In this instance, the rule of necessity would not have applied because there were more members that voted than there were needed to get to two-thirds. It just happened that one of the members voted against it. So, in this instance, I don't think the rule of necessity would apply, but I do think the broader issue is the legislature's decided that the only time that someone is allowed to kill endangered species incidentally is if they can get five members on the board. And if because of recusal and so forth, they can't get to that, that's something for the legislature to have to work out. It's a little bit different than, say, like the Intermediate Court of Appeals, where they added members to the court and then forgot to change the, like, how to deal with substitute judges. And so now, you know, there's a situation where you can't appoint somebody because the legislature sort of inadvertently missed that point. This one, it's the presumption is that endangered species should not be taken unless there's a really good reason to do so. And if they can't get to five, the legislature would have to change that from the authorized membership. And with respect to the second question, at least in the Second Circuit, the general practice is that when courts get ex parte communications, that they are filed as part of the record, and there's a cover sheet. It's like a stock piece of writing that says, pursuant to Moran versus Guerrero, parties are, no one is allowed to communicate with the judge, and that this is being filed to be part of the record. Now, obviously, I'm sure in family court proceedings involving children or other things with significant privacy interests, I'm not exactly sure because I've never been in a proceeding where somebody has done an ex parte communication and the proceeding is generally confidential. But I'm sure that's something that could be fleshed out. In this instance, every member of the board got a copy of the ex parte communication. So I know that Chair Case said that she told everybody not to read it, but the point is that in this case, every decision maker did get it. And that's a little bit different than the case in Kila Kila, where it was basically the chairperson, they were procedural issues, not substantive. And that the board at some extent in Kila Kila tried to right the ship. And the majority in Kila Kila said, probably not best practices, you could do it better. But in this case, what happened in this thing goes far beyond what happened in Kila Kila. There was no righting the ship. There was a hiding of the document, not hiding. It suddenly was not in the possession of the agency anymore. And so as a general practice, that these types of ex parte communications should be included in the record if it involves something that has a significant privacy interest or some other reason to be kept confidential, especially now with Jeff's and Jim's, that's very easy to include that on the record on appeal. And it, at least from the Second Circuit, with their use of the Moran ex parte thing, a procedure can easily be adopted with no burden to the government to do so. Well,
Justice Wilson, your question.
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Collins, I wanted to give you a chance to respond to the question I asked Mr. Minot. To what extent did the Endangered Species Recovery Committee review the change in the height of the rotors when it changed to 200 feet when it was considering the habitat conservation plan?
Your Honor, I was actually trying to look through the findings, because my understanding, and I can't unfortunately point to it at this moment in the record, was that the recovery committee did not consider the change to the increased blade height up to 200 meters, although it is now down to it's down to 170 something meters. But I, at this moment, I cannot point to it directly in the record. But my recollection is that the Endangered Species Recovery Committee did not consider the 200 meter, and that was something that the hearings officer noted.
And do you think that is a significant enough change to require that there be additional analysis?
Well, the hearings officer's finding was that that the height of the turbines may not account for differences in bat mortality, but there is not enough. I'm sorry, is Justice, okay. But that there's, that the turbine height alone may not account for differences in bat mortality, but it's a factor that should be considered. And to the extent that it wasn't considered, that's something that was outside of what the Endangered Species Recovery Committee actually had considered.
Very well. At this point, Mr. Collins, any brief remarks to wrap up?
Thank you, Your Honor. One other point that I wanted to mention was that HRS 2615 is what sets out the requirements for different members of the land board. One has to be a specialist in Hawaiian customary practices, and one has to be a specialist in conservation. And Mr. Gan was actually appointed as the specialist in Hawaiian customary practices, not as a natural resources conservation specialist, although he purports to be an expert in that as well. In conclusion, Keep the North Shore Country asks that the decision of the circuit court be vacated, and that the final decision of the land board be vacated and remanded for further proceedings, and that the agency be given instruction with respect to the handling of substantive ex parte communications, and that Mr. Gan should have been recused from the proceedings. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you to all of our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne kea aha ho'okolokolo ki'e ki'e hanahano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned. Recording stopped.